Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Peter Augustin Lawler, who served on President Bush's Council on Bioethics and is the author of Homeless and at Home in America, Stuck with Virtue, Aliens in America, and other books. He is Dana Professor of Government at Berry College and the executive editor of the acclaimed scholarly quarterly, Perspectives on Political Science. With Peter Augustin Lawler, we're going inside the pages of Modern and American Dignity, Who We Are as Persons, and What That Means for Our Future. Published by ISI Books. Welcome, Peter.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show.
I love Modern and American Dignity. This is one of those books that I think I'm going to go back to over and over again because there's just such a wealth of thought in it, not just yours, of course, but of all the wonderful thought-provoking individuals who contribute to raising us up in virtue and some of the thoughts of those who kind of drag us down.
Well, I appreciate that. The peak of the book is supposed to be, although not in an obvious way, the chapter on our philosopher Pope. And everything else kind of ascends and descends from that, although it's not supposed to be that obvious, because it's not supposed to be a polemical book exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of goes to the middle. So we start out with the controversies over the Bioethics Council and the new approach being taken by President Obama. And the book ends just talking about the place of America in the world and all that. And then you have these other thinkers like Chantal DeSalle and John Courtney Murray. And we learn some things from them, a lot of great things from them, but the best account of what it means to be a person, who we are and what we're supposed to do, actually is given by our Pope, and everything else ascends and descends from that.
That's the thing that I think is so compelling about the book, is that while you're talking from your perspective, from that vantage point of bioethics, I mean, ultimately it comes down to the dignity of each human person. And that's the real struggle that we seem to have today, this push and pull. Where does the dignity, where does the personhood begin?
Well, right, but you know, we have to think about who the person is, that we're the only beings in the cosmos that we know about, and we can't be absolutely sure, of course. We're the who's, everything else is a what. And even classical political philosophy, as wonderful as it is, makes the error of understanding human beings as simply kinds, as simply what's. But our unique and irreplaceable relational dignity comes from being persons. And of course you can know that without knowing of the personal God, but it's true that our longings, if you think about them as objectively as you can, do point in the direction of the personal God. So we are unique and irreplaceable, which is why even our Great Declaration of Independence is somewhat unclear on this in terms of the perspective of our founding fathers, but there was sort of a compromise where our kind of deistic Lockean founders like Jefferson compromised with the Calvinists, who were kind of had a perspective left over from the Puritans, and the compromise produced something better than either of the two extremes, so we have a kind of accidental Thomism there. So unlike other modern countries, which are kind of stuck with a kind of hostility to personhood, America has this kind of unique compromise-based beginning that was best appreciated by Chesterton. We have a nation with the soul of a church, and the soul of the church is this. We all equally have significance that comes to us from the personal center of significance.
That's a real question to go back to the beginning of our discussion. It's about personhood and when that begins. And that's the danger when that discussion is cut off. And that's been the attempt, hasn't it, recently?
Well, right. I mean, right. The attempt, I mean, you know, the attempt is not to have the discussion because of the absurdity of the way people, sophisticated people, think about things now. For example, as I mentioned in the book, the general way of looking at things is the Darwinian way combined with the autonomous way. According to the Darwinians, we are nothing but species fodder. Personal reality is an illusion. Human uniqueness is just something we need to get through the day, but it doesn't really exist. But these same people who are all whole hog Darwinians, and you have to put in parentheses very quickly, evolution did occur and all that. I'm not anti-evolution as such. But it doesn't explain what's human in human beings. In the same way, the same people, say a feminist or something, says, I'm autonomous, I'm free, nature doesn't tell me what to do. And so this very smart woman once wrote on one of my blogs, so what if Darwin teaches the whole truth? It doesn't mean I have to believe it or something, or have to act according to it, but it's a contradiction. So you have this Darwinian thing and this autonomous thing. And so really when we talk about ourselves, we sophisticates, and so not you and me, we talk of ourselves as kind of autonomous chimps. There's a kind of a contradiction there, but the contradiction exists only if you deny that we really are whole persons. Okay, we got this chimp dimension to us, we're animals, sure. We have this dimension of freedom, but they're a whole, they can't be separated from each other. And so a lot of Catholic natural law authors write against dualism, that there's some kind of opposition between human freedom and who we are by nature. And so once you start to think along those lines, then you have to start to think about what makes a person, when does a person come into being, and all that. And the great thing about the Bush Bioethics Council, I'm not endorsing everything President Bush did, is he appointed a council where the debate really occurred. And so there were great thinkers, like the great natural law thinker, Robbie George, who's kind of this philosopher, lawyer, relentless. He said, according to the science of embryology, from the very moment of conception, human uniqueness kicks in. And then you have this guy, Mike Gazanzica, the great neuroscientist, who said, well, human beings have brains and hearts. So with respect to embryos, no brain, no heart, no problem. And it turns out, I take Robbie George's side on this, but I'll be the first one to admit it requires an argument. It's tough. But anyone who thinks that there's no argument there, that enlightened people automatically believe embryos are just matter to be exploited in research, anyone who believes fetuses are not human beings, again, I think the argument of that is completely collapsed. Because even Mike Gazanzica would say once the brain and the heart have kicked in, as you can see and see in the ultrasound, the game's over. This is the type of argument our country needs to have, right? And so I have a view on this, and it's you know, it would take too long to set it up right now. It's like Robbie's, but a little different, but I reached the same practical conclusion. But I realize the people who disagree with me often very sincerely. They're not fools. They have arguments. But so what we need in this country is this public argument. In order to have this public argument, we have to take the issue of abortion away from the Supreme Court, as if this could be resolved judicially, as if we could look to the 14th Amendment and the Declaration of Independence and get a definite answer to it. It's a tough argument to have, but Americans need to have it. It needs to be part of our public deliberation. Our members of the state legislatures and Congress have to think about it. So they, if you want to say it, the evil doing of the liberals is not so much that they disagree with us, but they don't want us to be able to disagree with them. They don't want this to be settled by Americans talking to each other. And maybe in real life, although it's kind of repulsive in a way, sometimes reaching compromises because one side has not completely convinced the other yet. I mean, it's the same thing with respect to same-sex marriage. Americans need to argue about it. It's not a matter that can be determined in terms of rights by courts.
It's one of those things that when someone calls out, we have to agree to disagree and then go on. Well, no, that's not, because these are such fundamental issues. You need to have the discussions thoroughly.
Well, right. I mean, it's ridiculous. Unfortunately, that would be good. And some things, it would be easy if that were the case, right? And in many issues of life, that's true. That's the basis of religious tolerance. I think you're wrong, but I'm not going to have you arrested. I mean, it's okay there. But with respect to, say, abortion, a decision has to be made based upon the facts as we know them. Just like on the eve of the Civil War, Americans couldn't say we can agree to disagree on slavery, because the question is whether the African American has rights, and you can't just disagree on that. Mm-hmm. The law has to come down on one side or the other according to what we know, and if we disagree, then the majority has to prevail. And those who think the majority is wrong have to continue to argue, because justice takes precedence over the majority. But, you know, so it's not so different from the great issues in our country's history like slavery. I'm living here in the South. I admit, eve of the Civil War, some of the Southerners were sincerely mistaken, but they were mistaken. Mm-hmm. I think the people who are pro-choice and abortion often are very sincerely mistaken, but they are mistaken. And it's because we're actually dealing with an issue of who the person is, and so what rights really are. We have to argue about it, and we have to, as a democratic people, make a decision. But the decision is not made arbitrarily according to, you know, religious fundamentalism or something like that. It has to be a real argument according to who we are. And we who know we're whos, we have to convince the other side that we really are whos. But the other side really knows that, because they speak of autonomy. No one believes we're just like the chimps, and no one believes we're just like the dolphins. Tell a feminist, those dolphin women, they're okay with themselves, calm down. They're not going to buy that. We need to talk to the other side about the fact that you're confused. This autonomy thing doesn't make any sense. You're not really free from your body. You're not really free to deny biological imperatives. Women aren't free not to be women. Men aren't free not to be men. Mm-hmm. But in fact, these aren't, you know, kind of prejudices. They're things we have to work out through discussion. And my main objection to, say, President Obama and his administration is not that they disagree with me, but in fact, they want to use the Supreme Court and, you know, kind of a ruthless kind of view of what science is to prevent discussions. They want to call their opponents idiots who don't have a place at the table in a free country. But in fact, insofar as we know science, science is compatible with who we are as persons. You know, our Pope in the Great Regensburg Address was defending reason. He said we have unreasonably excluded certain topics from reasonable discussion. So that's what we have to say. We've unreasonably excluded certain topics from reasonable discussion. Let me say one thing about virtue, because I think I've been a little bit too strident here, trying to get too much in too fast. It is fundamentally a most optimistic book. I don't mm-hmm. think we have the power to destroy ourselves. The brave new world ain't coming. We don't have the power to turn ourselves into gods, as the transhumanists say. The immortality project is going to fail. And so we may live longer, who knows, and that's going to provide all kinds of problems for us, if you think about it. An aging society is not so pretty, right, mm-hmm. in certain ways. But at the end of the day, what we have there is a new, as Solzhenitsyn says, for example, we have a new opportunity for virtue. We're going to have to think again about the question. What are old people for in a society which has all these preferences for the young, all these techno preferences for the young? And so it's a great question of human dignity and a great opportunity for people who live a very long time. And the Bible's all for living a very long time. It's all for modern science extending the duration of life to some extent. I'm certainly very, very pro-science in that respect, and I'm pro-technology in that respect, except to say what we have are new challenges that give us new opportunities to display our virtue. It's actually going to be harder in many respects to be happy, and we see the absence of happiness in our time, and people just can't, you know, sophisticated people. Probably not so many listeners of this show, sophisticated people can't relax enough to have children because they're so obsessed with their own futures. There's a little bit in the book about the show Mad Men. People watch that show. People used to smoke. They used mm-hmm. to drink. They used to relax. We can't do that anymore, right? And they used to have kids. So I'm not endorsing everything about the early 60s, and I'm not actually so pro-choice on smoking, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't want laws against smoking, except to say we live in a very self-obsessed, death-haunted time, because people mistakenly believe that their personal existence depends entirely on their own efforts, and once they die, being itself disappears. Mm-hmm. The whole point of existence is me, because there's no foundation to my personal existence beyond my own efforts. Those are very bleak thoughts if you think about them, but they're also thoughts of free people. We're going to remain free. That's the good news. The bad news, if we keep thinking like that, we're going to be unhappy. The good news is it's going to remain the case that if you're going to feel good, the best way is to be good. And the other very, very good news for we Catholics is the longings we have that push us in the direction of God, the personal God, are not going to disappear. In fact, they're intensifying in certain respects. So I don't have a lot of hope for the future, like next week, in a way. But the future of each of us is secured. So I'm not all gloom and doom. And even with respect to abortion, if you think about it, every moment, every time of human beings has had unacknowledged atrocities. There were some great things about the Middle Ages, but there were some atrocious things, too, if you look at the facts. We have our unacknowledged atrocity of abortion. I admit that it's terrible. But sometimes when people get too angry here, I have to tell them, you know, God takes care of those little babies. Do what you can. You're going to fail, but God still provides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the victory's been won. It's what we do in this moment, how we stand and how we hold ourselves up, I think. And that's the choice that we have. We either fall into ourselves or we stand up in virtue of that love of neighbor, love of God, love of neighbor that compels us to go out and serve.
Right. So that's what Solzhenitsyn says. All progress is personal, right? The journey to perfection is not social so much. It's yours, right? The line between good and evil goes through every human heart. So don't expect too much or too little from politics. You have to do what you can. You've been given the responsibility of doing what you can. But finally, your future is assured.
That's why I was excited with this book in particular, because you really lifted up Pope Benedict XVI. And I just remember, Peter, when he came to the United States and his authentic joy with our country and with the people in it and the opportunity that we have and that he could see that we have. It's the potential, isn't it?
Right. I mean, and again, that's really something to underline and underline again. I mean, sometimes some conservative Catholics are, you know, too down on America, right? They say America is a modern country. The American Revolution was like the French Revolution. America's atheistic beneath the surface. But, that's not so true, actually. America has its problems, as do all countries. But you're right. I think the Pope kind of sees our greatness in a certain way. We are the most vibrant, even the most rational country right now. Europe's in this post-political, post-familial, post-religious fantasy. Depression is everywhere, and it's not so true of America. But America is what America is now because a third of the country is full of observant religious belief, which is not true, actually, of the rest of the West. And so I think the Pope, is critical of the way the sophisticated Americans understand themselves right now. But he really does see the personal reality, despite it all, is might be more alive in our country right now than anywhere else in the West. And so sometimes when talking to Catholics, conservative Catholics, say, you guys got to appreciate the evangelicals a bit more. Sure, their churches are ugly. They have no aesthetics. They have virtually no theology. But they believe the true moment, the key events of the Bible really did happen, and they're full of charity in all this, and they're having kids. And so we have, ours more than the other countries, we're not only a Christ-haunted country, we're kind of, comparatively speaking in the world today, we're a Christ-centered country.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully that it will remain that way.
Well, right. When I go into class, yes, but the great principle of political science is this. Things are always getting better and worse. So there are very, very wonderful times about living when we do. There are some really squalid things about living when we do. But all you can do in real life is do what you can to talk out the good and try to, and so far as you can, clamp down on the bad. Socially and politically, you're going to have successes and failures. But the ultimate success and failure is always personal. Mm. You finally are, you're responsible for yourself as a social and relational being. You can't, you know, collapse into yourself, withdraw into yourself. Which is why I'm not, you know, a really big fan of those who try to withdraw from American politics. And I'm all for countercultural communities as long as they keep some contact with the greater community, with their country. So I'm all for kind of a real but critical American patriotism. Mm. And just like I think we should be all for the great things our country has done for the world in the 20th century. Because, you know, imagine what the 20th century would have been like absent America.
Mm, right. Yeah.
I mean, we're the guys that won the second. We're the guys that won the Second World War, and we're the guys that defeated communism.
Mm. Well, and let me ask you this question. And, you know, in the country today, there seems to be a disrespect growing for what people perceive Catholic, quote unquote, Catholic social teaching is. And at its essence, what I've always understood is because of the dignity of each human person, from that everything else flows. And within the heart of the family as well. When did it become such a nasty thing, the idea of Catholic social teaching per se?
Well, you know, let's try to be charitable and say we have a certain kind of confusion that makes it hard. Mm-hmm. Because Catholic social teaching is attacked in two directions. One, from the point of view of science, for taking personal reality too seriously. And then one from the point of view of autonomy, for understanding ourselves to be fundamentally social and relational beings with responsibilities we're given by nature, you know, natural law. That we're hardwired to be family members, right?
Mm-hmm.
The family is the indispensable foundation of society. A society with no kids has no future. And kids have to be raised. Who can deny this? Which is sometimes why I talk up the Darwinians. They at least know that. At least every species has to reproduce. Every species has to pair a bond. Every species is a failure unless the kids are raised properly. So the Darwinians at least talk about nature. There's something good about that. Something, you know, I take the side of the Darwinians against the autonomy freaks. But the Darwinians deny our freedom, so I take the side of the autonomy freaks against Darwinians. And so the Great Catholic Project, and this is not an easy project to say, we are the scientific guys. We are the guys who want to put back together the kind of existentialism of autonomy and the old-fashioned empiricism of science. So we want to, you know, recover a genuinely natural science that counts as far as science can for everything we can see with our own eyes. So to me, the great American writer on this, the guy who we should really talk up, and I've read about him in other books, not so much in this one, is the philosopher, novelist, Walker Percy. He always said, you know, well, I'm talking scientifically here. And that's why I admire Robbie George. He said, you know, we got science on our side, right? So Catholic social teaching is not some kind of fundamentalism, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're right. Psychologically, we're right. I mean, you know, hookup culture makes kids miserable. No one's for this. But women dislike it more than men. It's true. Who can deny this? Who can deny what they see with their own eyes? It's natural for women to want to fulfill themselves as wives and mothers. That's a little bit harder for men. That's why women have to work on men a bit, right? And so, in other words, we have to, against the dogmatism that surrounds us, I guess, look at what you can see with your own eyes. It's not so much, you know, we don't have anything against gay people as such. We understand their struggles and so forth. But if marriage is not between, you know, if there is a biological foundation for marriage, then the biological foundation is what's required to bring two people together who relate to each other as persons with the task of raising children. If that doesn't exist, let's do away with marriage altogether. Are you guys really for that? You know, and again, you're not oppressing gay people to make this observation. Why in the world should someone be on their insurance of the partner if they don't have shared responsibilities, that is, children? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it just seems stupid. They should have their own insurance, right? I'm not putting it right. We should treat each other as individuals. Is anyone really in favor of going the whole hog autonomy route and saying all we have in our country is individuals? We can't recognize the social dimension of being human, the relational dimension of being human at all. And so, we know the Catholic teaching gets great disrespect, but I want to say it's not something that can't be fixed, right? Because the teaching that we're social and relational beings, open to the truth and given responsibilities. Those who deny that are engaged in self-denial. So I encourage all the Catholic listeners not to give up hope on this. Be in the public square. Be polite. Just say what you really know. All is not lost. And if all is lost politically, it's not your fault. Don't worry about it, but give it your best shot. Because when I talk to evangelical colleges, I say, don't be so defensive. Science is on your side. Ordinary psychology is on your side. What we really know about who you are is on your side. So don't withdraw into yourself. When you go to college, study science, study philosophy. Don't believe everything you hear. But these things aren't alien to you. These things can help you.
And practice the virtues, yes?
Right. And of course, but this was an indispensable teaching of all virtue, all science. Until the 20th century, virtue is mainly habituation. The best way to be happy is to be good. The best way to be good is to do good deeds. The best way to that's why the central virtue that's not political is charity. And the great thing about America is our government's not so charitable, but it leaves a lot of space for people to be charitable. So in other words, there's no way you can. Any social reform could eliminate the need for charity. In a high-tech, modern mass society, there's more room for charity than ever because in many ways people are lonelier than ever. As you were just saying, the collapse of marriage is horrible for women. We have more lonely single moms than ever. We have more kids who are just all messed up, have, as they say, issues than ever. This is great news for Christians. Because there's more opportunity to practice charity than ever. And charity is not, it's partly giving people money and clothes and all that, but it's partly just loving them, noticing they exist, talking to them, overcoming loneliness through personal connections.
Isn't that the great gift of our freedom?
That's exactly right. You're given the gift of freedom to exercise moral responsibility, and moral responsibility is not this kind of Kantian denatured thing. Moral responsibility is being good to other persons. You can see the need for this, even if you never heard of the Bible, right?
Mm-hmm. No, that's right. Oh, I could talk to you all day.
this has been the best interview ever. It's always the custom to flatter the interviewer at the end, but in this case, it's deserved. I've really enjoyed this.
Well, this has been absolutely wonderful. I loved it. And again, I don't doubt that I'll be sitting and reading it again and again and going
back
to it.
Well, it's so kind of you to say that. I really appreciate that.
We've been going inside the pages of Modern and American Dignity, who we are as persons and what that means for our future, with Peter Augustin Lawler. To obtain a copy of this book, go to isibooks.org. To hear and download this discussion along with many others, go to www.insidethepages.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.